So you broke a network cable that was in the ground?
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Is it a cat? It's cat 6, do you think, for the regular internet? Jason's going to hear this. Probably. He's going to be mad at me. Jason helped me install this. And about a year and a half ago, we took a cable. He was at one of the classes and he's looking around. He's like, you don't need this. You don't need that. He goes, we'll just run one from the house. He went and looked in the house. And he said, oh, all you need is a 400-foot burial cable. You know, one with a little bit more texture on the outside or a tougher thing. So we went from the house across the yard about 400 feet into the new black barn. And today, the guys were doing the driveway. He came up and he said, he goes, hey, I think I just broke a cable. He goes, it's like a little black wire. I was like, oh, which is, it's not a big deal, but I have to laser stuff in a few hours. So I have to splice so that I could, I'm going to have to just figure out how to connect my computer directly to the laser unit, to the full spectrum laser. So I'll figure it all out. So I have a splicing kit somewhere. I could splice it and bury it again. It's just, you know, it's one of those things where you think, like, you plan your day in your mind. You're like, oh, all I have to do is this, that. Oh, and then I have to find this, the whole package of splicing equipment, which I haven't seen since a year and a half ago. And I have to do this, and I have to bury the thing. And they're widening my driveway in front of the barn, my local landscaping guys. And he saw me walking the dog at 8 o'clock, and he called me over, and he's like, we broke a wire. Hope it's not anything important. Sticking out of the ground, it's like 2 5-foot pieces, 10 feet apart. I'm like, oh, that's my lasering job in 4 hours. Anyway, it's not. It could have been a lot worse. It's, you know, these things. Whenever these guys dig, a funny thing was once they dug a tremendous trench to do the electric from the street. They had to put 3-phase cable from the street all the way to the barn. And Derek from Malden came over one day, and he's like looking in the hole, and he goes, "You know, you guys cut a phone line, don't you?" I'm like, "We did." And he pulled me, and the hole had been dug for like a month. I didn't even notice it because that's what he does for a living. He called me over and he looked, he goes, look, and there was a cable like about as thick as my wrist with about 40,000 wires in it, ripped right open. I had only been looking at it from one angle. So I just thought it was a water hose, a black water hose, which no water was coming out of it. So I was like, I guess it's abandoned. But if you look at it from the other direction, there's like 10,000 wires hanging out of it, but they were cut very cleanly. And he goes, how long ago did you cut this? I go, they broke it about 10 days ago. He goes, no one's come to bother you yet? And I go, nope. He goes, then it must be abandoned. Because usually when these things break, they know right away.
Oh, yeah.
And because it was as wide as the bucket. So like one half of the wire was ripped out of the wall and laying face into the mud. So I just thought it was a hollow black water tube. And the other one was sticking out from the angle. You couldn't see all the wires in it. Anyway. And then about 10 feet away in the trees, half grown into one of the trees, is a porcelain placard from Bell Telephone. And it's grown into, it's got to be from like the 50s or maybe the 40s, because half of it is engulfed in the tree and it says Bell Telephone. So that must be. And then when we dug up a French drain by the barn, by the machine shop, which is about 400 feet away, they found the same cable. So it runs like diagonally through my property, right under every single hole we dig. So anyway, it's abandoned. But the little tiny internet cable, which is about as thick as a pencil, is broken. And I'm going to figure out how to fix it after we get off. No big deal. Learn something new.
Yeah, it's a pain in the butt, though, to strip those tiny little wires and.
Well, I'm gonna try.
You gotta do it twice.
I'm gonna try and do a connector, a connector, and a connector, and a connector. You know, a piece in the middle, and then just cover it with like 6 pounds of black tape and put it back in the ground. Everyone's punching.
<That'll do it. laughs>
Everyone's punching this computer screen. No, that's not gonna work.
That's what people do.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Anyway.
Well, other than that, what have you been up to?
What have I been up to? We're building trailers. I didn't put a movie out last week because I'm building trailers. We're building 8 bullet bourbon trailers that are going to go to Texas. And the last ones I built over probably a few weeks, maybe 4 weeks, 4 to 5 weeks, considering the prototype. Now, this 8, I started last Thursday, and now it's almost 1 week later. And they're just about, they're about 75% done. Because there's still a lot to do. I got to do the doors, do formica, build the bumpers. But with a team here, the team that I got helping me out is incredible. Everything's moving along really swiftly. And we're making tires. They're going to make 16 fake tires out of plywood. And every single tire uses up just about one full sheet of plywood. and takes 30 minutes to cut because I didn't even count. There's probably 60 pieces that I cut out, like little arcs of circles, and then we connect them together we layer them together like layered cake. And then 6 layers of plywood makes up one tire, one fake tire. And everyone's like, why don't you just buy tires? Because that means then I have to buy tires with rims, and then I have to connect the rims to something that's bolted. If I keep it all wood, I could just nail and screw everything. And if I do the cost analysis, it's probably the same amount of money to buy the plywood and take the time to put it together. But I don't have the ability to just nail and screw. I have to bolt and get involved with all the, you know, I have to go down the rabbit hole of using all the trailer equipment to connect the tires as opposed to just using wood screws and nails. Nothing has to turn, so it doesn't matter. So that's everybody that walks in the shop watches me cutting thousands of pieces of wood, making fake tires. I go, why don't you just buy tires? I do the whole script again. I just did. That's it. And, hopefully next week, are we going to talk about collections today? That's what we're going to talk about.
I think we are.
Yeah, we're going to talk about why we collect things, but this weekend's
video. We've got a 3-hour episode ahead of us.
This weekend's video is going to be my bandsaw video where I talk about my bandsaws if I can get it together, considering sweet. All the things I have to do between now and Sunday morning publishing.
Cool. What have you been up to, David?
We started version 2 of the chair yesterday and got most of the sides done. My funny thing is this guy that I used to work with, he's a graphic designer. He's a chair enthusiast, and he's the one that told me about when I worked with him. He would tell me about these famous chair designers and some of the chairs that he had and some of the chairs I should go look at the museum. And I never really like got into chairs, but he's the one that kind of got me into chairs. So he saw the video and he calls me up and he's like, dude, I want that chair that you just made. I was like, it looks cool in the video. It's not as flawless as it might look in the video because it's plywood and things chip out. And then when you put oil on plywood where things chip out, it doesn't always look perfect. And he's like it's art. I want it. I it's a prototype. So we started version 2, and if this version comes out fine, which I think it will, then I'll give this chair to my buddy Dunny. So after looking at that version 1 for a little bit, I thought it looked too CAD drawing, a little too computery. So we changed up the design a little bit. We're using PVC pipe as the seat part and the back instead of dowels, and it's coming along just fine. The side is made out of walnuts, and then I have this huge walnut slab, like this live slab, and I don't really care for live edge furniture very much, but I came across this piece from a retired farmer, and it only cost $15. I didn't want the piece, but I had to buy it for $15. And so I took that and then cut it up and resawed it for this chair. And I know people are going to cry when they see this, what could have been a river table or whatever, but I'm just not into live furniture.
Could have been.
And it just has some beautiful grain, and it's walnut that's been air drying for years. And it has a different color than a lot of kiln dried, because when they kiln dry walnut, from what I understand, they steam it so they can get more wood out of it, because the sapwood is a different color, and somehow when they steam it, the color bleeds into the sapwood, but it takes away some of the color from the brown. I don't know what I'm talking about. Somebody else can speak on that more intelligently, but from what I understand, air dried walnut just has a more brilliant brown than kiln dried, and so that is what we're working on. Yeah. And the dude that's getting the old chair, he's a chair collector, which is going to tie into today's topic, which Jimmy teased.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. I was curious about the PVC, because you mentioned it last week and then we never really got to talking about its strength or its like flexibility or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that the size of tube that you got is pretty flexible, I think, by itself, but it all depends on the length of tube that you're doing. So are you running into that, or is that intended, or like how's that affecting the stability of the chair?
So I got it in 10-foot lengths, and you can take a 10-foot half-inch PVC pipe, and you can bend it a lot. And so I took it home, and I cut it into an 18-inch section. You can barely bend that. So, and then this one actually has more dowels per inch DPI than the previous chair. So there won't be any flex, and it's the walls on that is pretty thick. So I don't know if I mentioned last week, I bought 3/4-inch PVC pipe.
You did.
Oh yeah. And that's the inside diameter, not the outside. So now I have a whole bunch of, I have 5 pieces of 3/4-inch, 10-foot long PVC pipe that I don't know what to do with, that I'm going to force myself to find a project for.
I have an idea.
But hit me.
You drive it up to Jimmy, and then you give it to him to run his Cat 5 cable through so he's digging in his yard again.
Wait, Cat 5 or Cat 6? Should I redo my Amazon?
Cat 6, Cat 7, whatever. I don't know. Whatever you're going to get.
220, 221, whatever it takes.
Doesn't matter, right? As long as the colors are in order at each one of the joints.
I don't remember enough about network cabling. There is a difference, and I don't remember which differences go with which type of cable, so I don't want to say the wrong thing. But there are differences. Like difference in thickness of wire and maybe number of connectors in certain cases and pair color or something. I don't know. But...
So you'll stick figure it with, out.
I'm sure.
Stick with what's there.
Yeah. So last week we, you know, we talked about a bunch of different stuff. I don't typically listen to our shows. I don't go back and listen to them. But after last week's show, I got quite a few messages from people that were like encouraging or responding to the show, which was super cool. It was great to have a conversation with some people and stuff. But after I got all these messages for a couple of days after the show, I was like, I don't even remember what we were talking about. So I had to go back on a run the last couple of days, and I listened to the show again. And you had some really good insight last week, Jimmy. I don't know if you went back and listened to it, but you had some good stuff to say around what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. And
I vaguely
right
remember.
After... I did.
No, I remember.
So right after that, I listened to that episode. I was listening to the Modern Maker podcast, their newest one, and they're going to be my pick. I'll just go ahead and say that for the week. But that I like listening to them talk about a lot of different stuff. I always enjoy when Ben has something very direct and very focused to say about something. He has really great insight. And it was really funny because it sounded like, and maybe it was just because it was on my mind, it sounded like he was responding to the things that I was talking about on our show, which I know doesn't make sense in the space-time continuum, so that didn't actually happen. But it was really cool after having just listened to myself go like, well, I don't know what to do about this, and I'm not sure how to handle this, and I don't know about this. And then to hear him respond to something else, but the responses worked very well in contrast to how I was thinking about it. So it was a different response than what we got on our show, but it still was very helpful to me. So I just thought that was kind of an odd coincidence to happen to listen to ours and then to immediately go to listen to somebody else's, and they have some really good insight on a similar subject. And it was pretty cool. If you don't listen to them, go listen to them. They're good dudes, and it's a good show as well. But just wanted to bring that up. I have... Actually, well, we're still talking about that. That whole conversation last week about the types of videos and why people watch them and all that stuff. We had a call, me and the guys on my team, and I was bringing all that stuff up to them and just like telling them, you know, I'm thinking about this and I'm thinking about this, and I don't know if we need to change maybe how we think about videos, or we need to change how we, I don't know. I just like couldn't put it into words what I was kind of unsure about, or like how we could improve things or how we could focus things or whatever. And over, I don't know, an hour, 2 hours worth of conversation with those guys, we came to a pretty what I think is a pretty substantial understanding of how I've chosen projects in the past and how we present them and how we've kind of settled into this path of this project has this outcome. This is going to be really abstract, and I'm sorry for that, but I don't know how else to say it. This project in my mind that I want to do has this outcome for the audience. Like it may be, you know, it has information in it. So this is like an information transfer. Maybe it has inspiration in it and we want to empower them to do another thing. But we have this rut of multiple types of projects, multiple types of output for the audience, but the presentation doesn't mirror the differences there. It's like one presentation. And it through this conversation with the guys, it really hit me that like we're not adjusting the type of presentation for the thing that we want them to get out of it. We're just like following our pattern that we accidentally set up for ourselves. And so like when we were talking last week about, you know, maybe some of these projects aren't big enough to like maybe be a video, or they don't have an oomph like a big epic video would, like you were talking about, I realized that we were not modifying the presentation or the focus of the video to match what we were trying to give the audience through the project. And so we ended up that, like, you know, we need to, before we start a video, think about like, what's the output here? Is it knowledge transfer? Is it inspiration? Are we trying to just get somebody excited about something? And then be flexible, like we talked about last week, being flexible to be able to change the format of the video or the focus of the video or how I present it or what I talk about to match the thing that we're trying to get across rather than just the pattern that we've been in. So I don't know if that makes any sense, mm-hmm. but the combination of the conversation here last week, the Modern Maker response, and then a big conversation with my guys about the work that we do, and having them all care about it and having them all put in really good input into our collective output, it was a really productive theoretical week. We didn't actually do anything, but we had some really good ideas come out of that.
So you have a fresh perspective going into the next few movies, maybe, basically, yeah. is what you're thinking. And then yeah. just to sum up what we talked about last week, for those that missed it, you were being a little bit too critical, hypercritical of the various different types of movies you would make, because you were kind of concerned about maybe view count, how long it would take you to do it, if somebody could do it or not do it. And as I remember, I was kind of encouraging you to just get out of your own way and just be creative and have fun with it. And even if the project takes 2 to 3 or 4 or even a summer's long worth of work, have it going on in the background and it gives you more fodder. And for instance, you have the R2-D2 directly over your shoulder there. And that's one of those projects that you're doing purely because you love it and it's part of the things you collect. Hint, hint, hint.
Yeah.
But it's really more, it's motivated in a different way, which I truly believe is contagious. You know, like for instance, I did the chicken coop a couple weeks ago where I made this like CNC chicken box that comes apart and goes back together easily. And someone's like, this is great, but I could never do this. I was like, all you need is a pencil, a jigsaw, a hand, and a brain. And he wrote back, he's like, wow, you're absolutely right. I don't know what I was thinking. So it's like, you know, I'm doing it because I'm sort of product oriented and I'm thinking in terms of like, oh, you know, giving the plans away and making a smaller version, blah, 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 blah. So I'm just always thinking in terms of how I could make things multiple times. That's why I use my machines. But if you're at home by yourself, you got to look at this thing and just like kind of look at it laterally and think like, don't look at the machine, just look at the product and go, I want to make that. Let me think of how I could make it instead of being caught up in the, you know, and what I'm telling you is don't get caught up in the how it happens. Just do what you got and let somebody else derive what they can from it.
Yeah. I think one of the things, I'm trying to figure out how to say it more clearly as to what I was actually thinking. I think if you take a particular project, you know, a lot of times I was taking small projects and thinking like there's not enough meat here to be something where somebody could take a lot away from it. And so that would make me start to kind of decide like, well, maybe these things are not really video worthy because they're just too small or they're too big or whatever there's some extreme that makes them not fit this mold as to how we get things across. And I think that was the big thing that we got to was like, how we get things across is what we do. That is the thing that should be more flexible. And if that means that it has to be flexible to work better for a small thing, then we have to change it. And if it has to work better for a big thing that takes a year or 2 years to do it, then we have to change it for that. Not all the time, but, and I think that was the thing. I didn't realize we were in a pattern. I didn't realize I was putting these constraints on myself to fit in, not necessarily like the weekly schedule, but just the, this is how we transfer knowledge to other people. And if a project doesn't fit that transfer process, then it's harder to work in. And like, we just need to be able to upend the whole thing and make it work for this specific, you know, whatever the thing is. So it was really good. And I think that, and just the encouragement from last week from you guys about, you know, just jumping in, chipping away at something big. It's been good. Yeah.
This is a beautiful moment, because this is where growth comes from, you know, your personal growth or business growth. And you may look back at this at, this was a pivot point. And when we started doing this, and then, you know, it takes off from there.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think it will be, because not only did we, in that conversation with my guys, talk about that, we talked about other patterns that we had been in that we didn't really realize were limiting things. Thumbnails was another one that came up. Like, we've been doing a consistent type of thumbnail for a really long time, and it's always had these couple of things that are just, from a design perspective, are just like, ah, wish we didn't have to deal with that thing. Wish we didn't have to make the text always fit in that little box. I wish we didn't have to crop a third off of our image to fit the thing. And through talking, we were like, we don't have to do that.
We make our own rules.
We don't have to do any of that.
Right.
Like, we can change all this. And so I think the conversation was a bunch of those, like, we don't have to have patterns. I mean, we can, and I think it's good to in a lot of ways, but those things can be more flexible. And that will allow us to every week or every project to say, like, what's best for this project? And the thumbnail needs to change to be what's best for the project. And the titling needs to change to be what's best for the project. And so does the way the video is shot. And so the way it's edited and how much music there is. And all those things can shift, you know, to that week for what's best for that thing, rather than trying to pick the best things to fit the format, which I think is what we were falling into without realizing it. So it's been good. And you're right, David, I think it is going to be a pivot point.
Everything evolves. And, you know, you got to be aware of it, and you got to, you know, be flexible enough to be aware of when you might need it. You know, you got to keep it fresh for you too. You got to,
yeah.
You know, this weekend I was going to try and jam in a video, but I was just like, you know what? It's okay to take a break every once in a while. It's okay. My next couple of videos might not be big build videos. I'm going to do the collections video, and then I might follow that up with a vlog, and then people are going to say, what happened? You used to make stuff. I'm just going to have to deal with it.
Yeah. Well, so what we have coming out this week, let me see if I can show you guys. Hang on just a second.
He has to walk around the R2-D2 as he gets up. It's so big.
It is in the way. So this is what we made this week.
Oh.
Is that silicone?
Can you see it?
A mat. Yeah.
It's a silicone mat.
So oh, that's
decided,
cool.
I decided to make a custom silicone mat. And I don't know if you can see in there really close. There's
CNC grooves. That looks like
laser.
No, it's part of his branding stuff.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's the circuit from the logo and stuff. And then there's like
bright.
A grid and a ruler. Basically, I just made an MDF form to pour silicone over, but in that I lasered in, just scored in really
nice.
Tiny details, and that silicone filled that up and became a positive in the final silicone, and it works so well, like way better than I thought it was going to work. I kind of thought like the detail will kind of be there, maybe some of the numbers will be there. It's perfect.
That's great. Did you use a barrier coat on the MDF? Did you like polyurethane it or something?
Yeah, put several coats of poly. I had to go back and so there's multiple pieces of MDF stacked up. So I made the pockets out of a positive piece and glued them on. The first go, the silicone did too well, and it seeped under the edges of the MDF even though they were glued down. So I had to go back and seal those up a little bit better. And then the whole thing got poly, and then also mold release just to break the surface tension even more. And so the first version I did, I used the wrong silicone. It was too stretchy. Like, it's crazy stretchy. And that one tore a little bit because it seeped under the pieces. But the second version, this one is flawless. It's great.
So it's great. Happy about it.
This project's been on my list for a long time, and I'm pretty sure we talked about it years ago, but I've been wanting to make like what you would see at a tavern, a bar, where they're making the mixed drinks and they have that little rubber mat with a little, like, you fingers. Know, 100 little fingers sticking up, and it'll have like Jim Beam branding on there. I've always wanted to make one for our little bar here. And so
That's
maybe
great.
Your video will inspire me.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty easy.
Imagine if you CNC'd that out of acrylic or out of aluminum and then polished it and then made hundreds of them.
Mm. I actually talked about in the video, like, how even sealing the MDF and sanding it, you can't get away from the texture of MDF. It's just like really little bit there. But if you were to cut those pieces, the exact same pieces, out of acrylic, man, that the finished silicone would be slick as snot. Yeah. It would be really, beautiful. Really nice. And or aluminum or something like that. But you know, the MDF was like such a quick way to be able to cut, because all of the positive pieces, there's a backing piece, and all the positive pieces that become the pockets have a bevel on the sides, so that when you have the final mat, all of the little pockets have slants down, so nothing gets stuck in a corner. Everything rolls to the center. And so things like that would be a little bit more difficult to do with, you know, aluminum. It would just take more machining time, and you may get chip out doing stuff like that on acrylic if you're not really careful.
There's a term for that, where it all slants in, right?
I just added a chamfer around the outside. I don't know what you would call it.
A draft.
A draft, yeah.
Mm.
With silicone, you don't have to worry about it, though, because it'll pull out. It's a matter of like it having two difficult, hard materials side by side. That's when you would need a draft.
Yeah, this was more for when you have the final mat, if you drop screws or little things down into the openings, just so that they won't get caught in the corners. No, it wasn't for the actual pouring process.
Gotcha. Do you guys remember a few weeks ago, well, now it's a few months back, I made a brass CNC, not brass, aluminum. I made the keychain mold for the injection molding machine. And the term, you didn't put enough draft on it, I must have got 10,000 times from people watching my videos. And I said, you know what? I'll figure that out on my own. And when I did not put a draft on something that was only 100,000 stick, it popped right out. So nana poo-poo on all of you. No draft. And it worked perfect. Like, well, sure, you should.
I kind of want to use that as the title, but I'm not going to.
Nana poo-poo. So... And then when I have mold release, forget it. The thing like literally falls out every time. Because when you injection mold it, and all the injection molding nerds who know everything, more than me, when you injection mold plastic, it shrinks a little bit. So it will pull away from the walls, but it will also snug around, like the letters, for instance, in my logo, in that particular keychain piece. So I know that I'll have to tug it out. So it's not going to get stuck in there forever, where it's going to be like Han Solo and the piece of metal, whatever that was. It's going to come out because it's plastic next to aluminum. People are like, you're never going to be able to get that out. You didn't put a draft on it. So anyway, that's me just getting back at all those molding nerds.
Hmm.
Works perfect, by the way. Well, it shouldn't have worked. I don't know why that shouldn't have worked like that.
Yeah, it shouldn't. You should do it again, and it won't work the second time.
Yeah.
So we're going to actually give away one of these silica mats, because it was fun to pour. And once I got it done, the guys that I work with are all like, hey, I want one. So I'm going to order more silicone. I'm going to pour some more, and we're going to give one away. I have a question for the two of you. I actually already know the answer, so I'm not sure why I'm asking you, but... have either one of you done a giveaway exclusively through Instagram?
I have a few times. I give away old tools.
Okay. So let me narrow that down. Have you done that without the thing of having people tag other people in?
Yep.
I hate that. I want to go on record. You can put this in the Library of Congress. I hate
having to tag. I don't tag. I just say, I go like this. I go, I wrote a number on the palm of my hand from 1 to 100. And the first person in sequential order going down the comments that gets that number wins the prize.
Hmm. Oh. There you go.
And then I wait for somebody I like to show up with the number. Then I write the number in my hand. And then I show up.
Beautiful.
No, of course I don't do it that way. But that's the way I do it. And then the next picture will be the palm of my hand. I haven't done that since I was in the city. I remember doing that to give away a lot of tools. And because we had so many duplicates of everything from all the TV stuff that I had. I had all these extra tools and we just needed space. And so I started doing that for like a little bit of time. Haven't done it lately. I'm working with Ferd, which is the grinding company. They've been asking me to do that like tag giveaway thing. I still haven't done it because I'm reluctant to do the same thing that you did, Bob. But with Ferd, for instance, and this isn't, I don't know how this will apply to you. They just said, have people join our Instagram and make a comment on a recent post. And then we'll pick the person that gets the prize on your channel. So that's easier because you only have to tag them. You don't have to tag. So, you know, you don't even just have to go back and follow them. It's just a way to drive traffic to their Instagram.
Yeah. We did one with Aero Fastener recently and it was like that where they just had somebody had to go follow them and leave a comment and then they picked it, which was nice for us because we didn't have to deal with the flood of comments or the picking. But, you know, this one's going to be from us and I just don't want to overcomplicate it for people, and I don't want it to irritate people who are not in the giveaway because that's what that tagging thing does. I get tagged, all of us get tagged constantly in other people's giveaways, and it's just
Have them write a 500 word essay why they think that they should have it, and then you could choose it. Mm. And you guys can
mail
read 700
it, write it, hand write it, and mail it to the PO box.
Yeah.
And we will pick it next year sometime when I have time to read them.
Yeah.
Well, all right, we'll figure out the giveaway. That's not a big deal. Okay, I'm done talking about all my stuff. David, you have a topic?
Yeah. As usual, we started the podcast. We got on the call and we're like, what do you want to talk about? I don't know. Maybe today we won't do another topic. We'll just talk. And then I'm looking up and I have hundreds of books right above my head here. I'm like, we haven't, after all these years, I don't think we've talked about what we collect in our collections. And so Jimmy, I didn't know if Bob collected anything, and I didn't have to ask Jimmy because Jimmy buys buildings for his collections. But
he collects metal.
I think it would be interesting to talk about why we collect things and the feeling that we get from them, and is there a purpose or is it just purely I have to have this thing.
It's funny. A teacher of mine, I had always been collecting things my whole life. And then Mark Seta Ducati, who I've talked about various times, Mark Seta Ducati was my teacher in my final semester before I graduated art school, the School of Visual Arts. And I only had Mark for one semester, but he became one of my, I had two teachers, and Mark and Kevin. And Mark was one of my closest, biggest inspirations, closest friends. And he has lots of collections. And when I went to his apartment, started working for him and helping him develop toy design, he always says, you got to have collections because they inspire you to make new things. And he had all kinds of, like, he had collections of sunglasses that had mechanisms. He had collections of wind-up toys, collections of, like, little types of soldiers. But there'd be something very specific about them that would inspire him. And I'm holding a collection right here in my hand. It happens to be my, it's out the front knives. Knives that are mechanized to go in and out of the handle. You know, they're legal, but I have automatic knives. I have like 20 of them in my desk. And anytime I
they're
see...
They're illegal, but I've got tons of them.
Well, don't anybody rat me out. But, you know, it's like every time you buy one, and they're like, here you go. And they go, oh, are you a cop? I'm like, not exactly. And they're like, all right, just don't tell anybody, you know, because the store wants to still sell a $300 knife. So anyway, so buying things that inspire you to help your product development. I think it's really important for anybody that develops products or develops videos or develops like art to collect things. Of course, a lot of artists collect flat images. And you know, my ex-girlfriend used to collect vintage postcards, and she still does. I mean, we're still friends, and she would have all this vintage paper, and like we'd be at a flea market and she'd find somebody with like and she'd freak out because she's like, oh my god, look at the printing quality of this, or look at the way the graphics are set up. And I never really took a close look until she inspired me to really look at antique printing and, you know, the vintage postcards and Valentine's Day cards. She has tons of that stuff, all like die cut shapes. So I think it's really important as an artist to collect things that inspire you And, you know, I said it once in my TEDx talk to go into the slurry in your brain, and that soup helps you come up with new things. And the only way to feed that soup is to collect stuff. And even if you buy one thing, that's, you know, you collect people collect brass, you know, things made out of brass or things made out of silver. It doesn't necessarily mean they're all like Zippo lighters or whatever. There was an interesting store in my neighborhood in the Lower East Side. She ended up moving, but it was a little antique shop, and the girl there had everything in the store in color coordination. So you walk into the store and there was a section of just white things, a section of blue things, a section of red things. It was incredible because it was mostly 60s, 70s stuff. And she had a tone of blue, and everything in that was all the same color, whether it was a toaster, whether it was like an egg beater, or whether it was a book, or whether it was a piece of furniture. It was the coolest thing. And that she's a graphic designer, an art director that opened an antique shop. So that's what happens. Like that's what a graphic designer does when they open an antique shop. They arrange things in color order. And so I think it's important. It's important to inspire.
I can't say whose house it was, but I was friends with a guy who is a roommate with, who turned out to be a famous rock star later. And I was over at their house. This is maybe 15 years ago. And there was all this guy who is now a famous rock star. He had all of these tiny little alarm clocks, like the with the little bells on there and the hand dials, just all along every single windowsill. And I realized, like, individually, those little clocks, they didn't have a purpose. They meant nothing. But in a group of a bunch of them, they all have this new energy, and it gives them a lot more meaning. And I was like, that was the first time I realized, like, collecting stuff can be super cool and inspiring, and just visually something to look at when you add all these things together.
Yep.
So what are the things that, and you said books, but like, what are the things that, is there anything other than books, or is there a certain type of book or something that gives you that, like, the mass of the collection is the thing that's interesting?
So other than books, I have probably two or three dozen cameras, all bunch of a lot of Polaroid cameras, and then just film cameras and a couple old video cameras. They are there purely for decoration and looks. And some of them I use. And I used to really, really be into photography. And I know one day I'm going to get back into it. And I look at them for inspiration, but they just, as a collection, again, they look cool. And then the books serve a huge purpose in what I do. I collect anything that has to do with art or making, woodworking, metal, crafts, anything, any kind of, or inspiration. I like books with collections of things. Like, I have the 500 cabinets, the 500 boxes, the 1,000 lamps, and I'm looking at them right now. There's a book of 500 cameras. I like looking at collections for inspiration. And with what I do, I try to draw my inspiration from books rather than from the internet or from YouTube, because I'm assuming, I may be wrong, but I'm assuming everybody else is gathering their inspiration from the internet, where I already have this library of stuff right here that I can just go and I can flip through it. And there's something about that physicalness of the book that speaks to me. And when I was doing my chair project, just because I've been collecting these books for years, I've had five or six books just on chairs, and I just pulled them all out and I just started flipping through. And then things that I found interesting, I just took a photo with my phone. So then for the next couple of days, when I had nothing to do or I'm waiting for something to happen, I can just flip through that little album that I had on my phone and stare at them and wonder what were they thinking when they made that particular thing. And that's where the books come in really handy. And then sometimes I need a book because I just want to learn how to do this particular joinery method or this particular thing. I tend to trust books more than I trust the internet, because there's this time and energy that it takes to make a book, and I just love books, and it's a habit now. I see a book and I have to have it, and I don't. Maybe it's a problem because it's not going to go away anytime soon. I still want all of the books, and they look cool on the shelves.
Collecting books isn't a problem. Collecting anvils or cars or power hammers, that's a problem.
Actually, I can't wait to talk about that.
So don't feel bad.
Yeah.
You know, so when you have a problem is when you buy a car and you don't tell anybody. That's when you have a problem. That's been my problem this week. I bought a new car and I haven't told anybody. Because I don't want anybody to be like, oh, you bought another pickup truck? Yes, I did. And I'm admitting it here for the first time.
What did you get?
I can't say.
Yes, you can.
Well, you have to now.
You already did. Come on.
I bought a 1977 Chevy Stepside pickup truck.
Oh,
needs
man.
Work. I got it from a local guy in the neighborhood months ago, like maybe even a year ago. I saw it at this parking lot, and I said to the guys that I met there, they wanted to sell me a printing press. And they meet me here. I went to this shop. It's right in my neighborhood. And I looked at it and I was like, you know, this isn't really a printing press that I'm interested in, because that's a whole nother collection, of course, but it's like an A.B. Dick printing press from like 1980. I'm not into that. I'm into the antique cast iron. So I was like, no, I'm not in. I go, well, what about that pickup truck? He's like, well, that might be for sale soon. I go, well, let me know. And these are guys that I've come to know in the neighborhood from just being around. And anyway, Dave reached out to me a couple weeks ago and he's like, that pickup truck might be available soon if you want it. I was like, all right. So he dragged it over to our complex because he's in my complex. And he's like, it's there if you want it. And he goes, if you don't take it, I'm going to put it up for sale in front of the building. And I was like, I'll take it. Looked at my shoes and kicked the dirt. And I was like, I'll take it. But it is really cool. It's a 1977 Chevy Stepside. It's like kind of rusty. It's got an interesting story in the way that it was getting rebuilt by a mechanic, and the guy who owned it died in 9/11. I don't know much more about it, but it sat inside the mechanic shop for about 15 years. And then when the guy needed the room, he pushed it outside. And that's why it's rusty, because it's been outside for like the last 3 years. It's not rusty rotted. It's just rusty dirty. But it's a 77, so it's got all these cool, hokey, like John Denver Muppet graphics on it. So I'm not going to be able to save them, because to repaint it, I'm going to have to remove all these ugly, stupid stickers. But it's silver with burgundy slashes and lines all over it. And it had a camper in the back, which they took off. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, that would look so cool without that camper on the back. It was like a camper stuck in the bed. And when he showed it to me the other day without the camper in it, I was like, okay, you got me.
That front grille is iconic for that.
Yeah, and this has like a custom ugly one in it, which I'd have to change, but I'll show you guys a picture of it. But anyway, collecting cars like that, like for instance, I'm working on the Cadillac, and I'm working on the Cadillac with Art Clement, a guy I met through Instagram who lives near me, and he's an engine guru. I call him my engine guru and my engine teacher. And he looks at it 5 minutes. He tells me what, and like, these are things I never grew up with. I never grew up with someone that mentored me with engines. And now Art comes and hangs out and helps me. And Art came over the other day when I told him I was getting my collection from Mr. Pete. I had it shipped here from Central Illinois, and it showed up on Sunday. Art was here to help me take them off the truck and look how they run. And Art's like, you SOB, now I'm going to have to start collecting ancient hit and miss engines. I bought 3 hit and miss engines from Mr. Pete a year ago, but because of what happened this whole year, I never had a chance to drive out and pick them up. So I just arranged shipping. So buying these collections or having things to starting to collect them, for me, is just inspiration. It gets my gears turning. It literally gets me thinking. Like it puts me in a frame of mind to start thinking how the designers who built these things, built these cars, made these cars. Like when I look at an old car, I don't just look at the old car. I think of the guy sitting at the drafting table and making decisions about the curve of the taillight, what this side looks like in relationship to that part of the car, and how big the wheel should be. So when I look at all these antique things that I collect, I that's how I see them. I don't necessarily, I mean, obviously they're cool objects and they inspire me because just the object of them, but it helps my gears start to turn to think of the thought process that went into them. And the funny thing is with my ancient machines, the ones that are all cast iron from the turn of the century, the first thing everybody looks at when they say, first thing say when they look at them, they go, can you imagine somebody built that with just a pen and a paper? No computers. Mm-hmm. And it really gets everybody thinking like, wow, imagine life before computers, which was only 40 years ago.
It
helps me think that anything is possible, because when you see a machine from 1880s and it's made out of cast iron, somebody made it out of wood first, somebody developed the mold, it makes me think that anything is possible. So when I come into a little bump in the road in my shop, I'm like, somebody made that printing press and it's still working 125 years later.
That's a good point. Everybody knows that you collect apparently trucks now, and bandsaws and anvils and printing presses. But is there something that you collect that probably most people don't know? Ooh, that's a pretty truck.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
That's cool. That is cool.
Thank you. You guys just fed my my addiction. Thank you.
Is there something that you collected that like maybe nobody knows about? That's like not a tool. Is there something? I know in the past you've had like weird bones and stuff around your house, and like different little interesting things. But I don't know if those are collections. Is there a thing like that? That's something that, you know, is just visually interesting to you that maybe isn't as obvious.
I'm looking around the room. I collect. I have more man purses than I should. You know, like tool bags. Toolboxes. I can't stop buying toolboxes. Zippo lighters, old manuals. Like you talk about books. I'm looking at one right here. This is a technical manual, hand measuring and power tools from the Army from World War One. It shows like the farm boy how to use tools. So anything that has interesting old like drawings in it, I'm showing these guys. This is from May 1941. I do collect books, but the books that I typically buy are old books that inspire me how to bookbind. So I'll buy old, like the other day I bought for $1 at the flea market, and I have a few of them. I don't necessarily have them all in the same spot. They're randomly, so I have to collect them and put them together. But this isn't it, but this is a book that I made. But I bought a book the other day for $1. It's from 1877. It's a math book. And it's so funny. My friend opened it up, and the math equations in it are impossible. My buddy goes, this is when people still had brains. That's why this book, it's like, John goes to the farm. He gets 6 eggs, and then he gets 4 chickens. And each egg weighs 3 ounces, and each chicken weighs 14 ounces. And then it goes on, and then the sentence is like 15 more sentences long. And it's like, how many eggs would he have after this? And they're like, wait a minute. I was like, I'm completely lost on sentence one. So the equations and the questions and like the mental backflips you have to make to answer these questions are real. And it's just a math school book from, middle school. And it was $1. But I really bought it just because of the printing on the pages and how it's bound and the way it's made. And it's assuring to me to open it up and realize the bookbinding is basically the same way that I'm bookbinding my books now. And it's a 150-year-old book.
There's something about those old objects that just they have a previous life. And most of the books are from before I could read. And there's just like, what's the history of this book? Or you've got to wonder what the history of this printing press is. And it's got stories that you don't know about, but it feels special to you because it lived a life before you.
That's a good way to put it. I do have that feeling of mystique around old objects, and it doesn't even feel, I don't feel it specifically to books or musical instruments or tools, but I feel it for all those things. But like, I could go into an antique shop and not really care about the things and not want to take them home, but still be fascinated just by walking around and looking at this thing's existed well before me, and it was made by a person who grew up somewhere and had a life and had a this and had a that. And that object in and of itself may not be anything, but it is evidence of lives lived and knowledge and moving from one place to another. And so I think that's the stuff that really makes me interested in old stuff. not necessarily collecting those things, but having a moment of realization with those things.
I like when you get a toolbox and it has someone's name etched in it. It gives me that same feeling. Like this, yeah, this was somebody's like pride and joy for a moment, you know, or at least a part of this collection was.
It's weird. I have this, this is not really related, but I kind of have the same internal feeling around deep places of nature. So like when we go to the farm, you know, when you stand in a field, an open field, and you just see grass, it's like, even if it's pretty or it's not pretty or whatever, like, this is a thing. But when I go deep into the woods and I go to a place where there's rocks sticking out of dirt, overhanging water, and there's tree roots coming down, there's an entire huge system of life in a square foot.
Right. You think about right how there. Ancient it is, too.
Yeah, and like that's the stuff, and it's the same internal feeling I get when I see like old stuff. It's just like, man, there is so much that's not me right here in this little area, and I get fascinated just by like digging through, you know, not looking for like treasure or even animals or anything. It's just like, I don't know. It's a kind of pulling out of. Not always looking at your own self and how you impact things and how you are impacted things, but just like looking at there's stuff that exists without you. And that's really cool. You know, that's kind of grounding. But I think when it comes to actually accumulating, actually collecting those things, I have, and this is not a judgment call on anybody, but I have like over the years have gotten a tendency to push back really hard on that. Not in everything. I mean, I'm surrounded by toy robots and Transformers and R2-D2 things, so I'm not being like a holier than thou. I don't collect anything. But I've started really second-guessing when I go to get something. Oftentimes, I will... R2-D2's on my brain. It has been for a couple of years, right? So I'm picking up like these model kits that are R2-D2's, and I have a figure over there, and I found a figure over there that was really cool. I spent a kind of stupid amount of money on a carded R2-D2 figure from 1983. So I do, but every time I go to make an addition to one of those collections, I go like, what am I going to do with that after it's not interesting to me anymore? What are my kids or my wife going to do with that when I'm gone? How are they going to have to deal with that? And I go through this like, and maybe it's too real, I don't know, but I go through this, what's the ramification of piling on things to my space for other people after I'm not here to deal with it, or after I don't care about it anymore and I'm still here. Like I used to collect Transformers when I was a kid. I loved them. They're fascinating to me, just the mechanics and the visuals and all that stuff. And so when I was old enough to have money to waste on things as an adult, I started buying these old Transformers, and I bought a lot of them. And I put them on shelves, and I had a big thing, and it was so cool to look at, and I enjoyed looking at them. And then at one point, I kind of like stopped being interested in looking at them. And so now they're in a box, and that box is something that eventually I'm going to have to figure out what to do with. I'm going to have to, I've never wanted to waste the time eBaying them, but I also don't want to just like give them to Goodwill, because there is a lot of money in that box. And so I remember back to that feeling of like, I was really excited about a thing. I invested a bunch in it, and now I'm not as excited about it, but I've still got that investment in play. That investment of money and that investment of space and of, you know, eventually having to do something with them. And so now I start to second guess anytime I want to start being interested in something to where I want to buy a bunch of it. I'm like, oh, it's going to be a box of Transformers one of these days. You know, like, I don't know if I should do that again. So I guess it just makes me more picky, more choosy. And I've also, you know, I try to think about the reality of nostalgia, how like there's so much stuff that I get just because it picks at that nostalgia, that thing you can feel. Like that's a feeling I haven't felt since I was 7 years old, since I was 8 years old, since I remember that smell from that time when I was a kid, and that, you know, and you want those nostalgia things to be brought back up in you because they feel good. And it's so easy to be like, I'm going to go buy this toy that I had when I was a kid because it's going to pull that little thing out of me. But then you're going to have the money gone, and you're going to have the thing sitting here that you're going to have to do with once that feeling fades. And so like I wrestle with that a lot. Interestingly enough, I collected toys for years, years and years and years. And I have a lot of old Transformers. I have all my toys from when I was a kid. And my brother and sister were older, a little bit older than me. So my toys were my toys. Like, they didn't care about them. They were older. So I was particular about my toys. I kept them in pretty good shape. You know, I played with them, but I didn't like lose all the pieces and stuff. And so I still have those now as an adult. My kids don't have that. They have toys just like everywhere. And there's four of them and they're almost the same age. You know, they're in the same range. So everybody's stuff is everybody's stuff. And so they don't have the same attachment to their stuff that I had when I was a kid. And I think that's awesome. I'm glad for that. But it is a really weird distinction because as an adult, you know, like I have this die-cast Millennium Falcon that I had when I was a child, and it's sitting on my desk. And my kids probably won't have something like that that's sitting on their desk because they don't care as much about the physical stuff around them right now. I think that's a good thing overall, but it is a really weird breakup mm-hmm. between how I view stuff as an adult as to how they're going to probably view stuff as an adult. And so I guess I'm saying that from like I'm kind of conflicted about collecting. I like finding things, but having the things is the how I get conflicted about it. And I kind of hope that they don't have that same thing that they have to deal with when they get to be adults, that they don't feel so attached to the stuff that they had and they want to have more of it. Now, I do think there's a big difference between collecting things that are nostalgic for you and collecting things that inspire you. Like you're talking about cameras and books, and those are things that now do something for you mm-hmm. now. In what you're doing now. And a lot of the stuff that I've collected and the things I'm talking about are a little bit more of just attachment to the past. And they don't really do anything for me now. Like, you know, having Star Wars figures around me and stuff doesn't actually inspire me for the most part. It's just a good feeling to have them around. Jimmy, what are you holding up?
I'm holding up, it's a little Buddha that I got in a gumball machine when I was probably 10 years old. And it's been in my life. Ever since. It's sitting here on my desk. Hmm. You held up the Millennium Falcon. It's a little Buddha. I remember there was like a thing of like these kind of like fake ivory sculpted things in like a Foles gumball machine at the Key Food where I grew up. It used to be called Bohack when I was a kid. And there was a quarter, and this was the one I got. My mother, here's a quarter, go do that while I pay for groceries. And I've had it ever since. And I always consider it like a dumb little good luck charm. I'm not really that superstitious, but... And I always think as long as I have it, everything's going to be cool. But I made that up when I was a little kid. Now I think that about everything I buy. As long as I have this, everything's going to be okay.
As long as I have another truck.
But it's like, it's a little Buddha and it's like fake ivory art. And I've had it for 40 years. It's always been in my orbit for 40 years. I moved from my mother's house to three different apartments in Manhattan. From Manhattan to this house up here, all that moving, and it's still like within 5 feet of where I sit and do my things. And that's because it's always like, oh, there's that thing. I don't want to lose it. Let me just put it here. And it's happened all this time. And why? I found it again recently. It's sitting here on my desk. I found it on the bookshelf. And I'm like, I can't believe this thing is still following me around. I haven't lost it yet. That was about 10 days ago.
The good thing, though, is that you have that type of attachment, that sentimental attachment to a thing that can fit in the palm of your hand instead of every single one of your anvils. That would be a problem. If you were like, everything will be okay as long as I'm surrounded by anvils all the time.
Yeah.
Then you would just like move them into your house, build some walls out of them.
Yeah, that's a good idea, X. Make a wall. Anvil wall.
But I do think, in all my ramblings there, I do think there is a pretty big difference between collecting things for the now and how they can affect, you know, how they can inspire you and how they can affect your future versus collecting things that are just attached to your past. Neither one are bad. I'm not trying to make a judgment call, like I said. But I think I'm resistant to them in general because I feel like it's just... the collection from the past thing for me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like, I'm just going to be accumulating and I don't really need to accumulate. If anything, I need to get into the habit of looking for things that, that can pass through me as a way to inspire stuff now. You know, I don't necessarily have to own them or put them on a shelf, but things that I can see, things that I can interact with, and then they pass through me on to somebody else so that I have that bit of inspiration from them or whatever.
My final thought is I hope that my book collecting remains healthy, because I get that feeling of, like, if I see an old book, you know, at an antique store or the thrift store, I have to have it. I feel like I have to get it. And I make up this reason why I have to have it. Well, I use it for inspiration for my job. I could see this, like, in 10 years from now, like, just hoarding all of these books and this being this unhealthy thing. And collecting books isn't like collecting, like, there's people who collect guitars. When you're over it, you can sell those guitars, and some of those guitars are going to be worth more money. These books, they're not going to increase in value. They're going to end up at a thrift store someday after I pass away. And I just hope it remains healthy, but I could see how it could easily get out of control.
Do you think it's one of those things where you, instead of it being a, you keep everything until you're gone and then it all goes away? Or could it be like I'm getting some new books, so I should find a few that I'm not really into anymore and start to go ahead and, like, let them pass, you know, pass through.
Maybe that'll be my thought process in the future. But right now, I don't like getting rid of them, because as a whole, they have more meaning. As a whole, it's visually pleasing to me to look into my office. When I walk into my office and I see these hundreds of books, there's something warm about it and something inviting to me. So even though, like, I can look at a book and I'm like, I am never going to open that book. Like, this is The Art of Polymer Clay. Like, really, am I ever going to open up that book? But as a whole, I love the entire collection. Although I might change my mind. Maybe someday I will do something in polymer clay. Who knows? But
yeah, interesting. Cool. Well, you guys got anything else about this? We're like an hour in.
So. No, I just say, I mean, if I in summation, I would say collect things that inspire you. That's really the main reason we collect things, is because we want things to inspire us to do other things.
Yeah. And I guess there's also a thing. When I think of collections, I think of huge masses of things. But, like, you can have four or five of something and it's still a collection, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be an unhealthy, like, I don't know where to put all these things. So I guess that is an unfair kind of way that my brain...
Do you guys know Jocko's crazy collection of Jimmy DiResta stuff? Like, when Jocko comes and hangs out with me, he just picks things up and goes, do you want this? I go, you could have it. He was like, he knows the things in my periphery that I don't really care about, but they might have been like a means to an end or like a sketch model. And he's like, he just holds it up. I'm like, you could have it. Like, you don't even talk now. He'll be like, I mean, you can have it. And so he always ends up leaving. And the other day I put together a box of him. And just yesterday I made this push stick video where I ended up with a few iterations, and the real early iterations, which I didn't even show on camera. I was holding them up. I'm like, should I throw these away? And Aaron goes, give them Jocko. I'm like, perfect. So yeah. I'm going to start another Jocko box and mail it to him. But Jocko has like a Smithsonian collection of like Jimmy DiResta, like fodder, just scribblings and like half made prints and things that, you know, accidents and cutoffs and stuff.
Yeah. He can open up the, I just thought of cutoff shorts. I don't know why. Like he has a pair of your jeans that you cut off into shorts for
some reason. I have a pair of
them. He can start the European Jimmy DiResta Museum one of these days.
Yeah. Like get off the main highway and travel to see you. Sell hot dogs and coffee.
Cool. Well, I want to thank our Patreon supporters while you guys figure out what you want to recommend. Big thanks to everybody that helps us out over there. We always say it, we are grateful for everybody over there, and everybody gets the after show no matter what level they're supporting at. So if you want to get that, go to patreon.com/makingit. But I want to say a big thanks to our top supporters: Albers Woodworks, Corey Ward, Works by Solo, Chad from Mancrafting, You Can Make This Too, Maker in Training, Fun Kiss Artistic Creations, Blondie Hacks, Rich at Low End Design, and Odin Leather Goods.
That was a drum roll.
Some weird drum roll. Underwater drum roll. So big thanks to everybody that helps us out over there. We are very grateful.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was thinking this morning about, like, this is episode 271. We should do a episode, or like a making it 300. Oh, wait, we can't because there's a pandemic and we can't get with people. But if we were to do something like that, I would definitely want the our Patreon supporters to be there for that. So
we need to do a big Zoom meeting. I listened to a couple of comedians and they've been doing like Zoom, big Zoom collections of fans. Wonder if we could do that. Big Zoom hangout. That would be fun.
We can do that. We do a monthly, for I Like to Make Stuff, we do a monthly hangout with our Patreon, top tier patrons, and it's really cool, man. I've gotten to know some people there, and we always, everybody checks in on each other and has like inside jokes about what everybody's been working on stuff. It's very cool. All right, I'm gonna recommend, like I said before, the Modern Maker podcast, the newest episode. I don't remember the name of it or the number, but it's the newest one as of today, August 5th, so go listen to that one. What do you guys have to recommend?
I got Tim Rowett. I've talked about him in the past, in the last 275 episodes. Tim Rowett is an old friend. I haven't seen him in many years, but when I used to go to Toy Fair every year, and I met Tim through Mark, who I talked about in the beginning, Tim collects toys, and he has a very successful YouTube channel called Grand Illusions. It's Tim Rowett, and Tim collects interesting toys. He has a lot of viral videos, so you might recognize him. But years ago, I'm talking like 25 years ago, we used to go to Maker Faire, and Tim, the highlight of Maker Faire was sitting at the Chinese restaurant on Irving Place. We'd pick one day during the toy fair, which usually 2 weeks long, and we'd all sit around, have dinner, and then at the end of dinner, Tim would pull out collections and just pass them around the table. There'd be like maybe 30 of us at dinner, and Tim would, like, he'd be at the end of the table and hold up something and describe what it is, and he goes, I got this in China, and then he'd pass it. You know, I got this in Germany, it's like a woodpecker. And it would be the most interesting mechanisms. Like, he would make sure he curated the collection to be the most interesting, coolest things, and then we'd all sit at the table, discuss how it was manufactured, or, and it was just it was something that it was my highlight of Maker Faire. If I look back, it was, when I say Maker Faire, I meant to say the Toy Fair, New York's Toy Fair, which I haven't been to in many years. But so check out Tim's channel, Grand Illusions. And he does exactly what he would do at dinner when we would all hang out years ago. But now he does it on YouTube.
That's cool.
I have Wobi Design. So Ben from Wobi Design put out a video the other day called the Wobi Camera Jig. And his videos are so well done. He, his shop is in a shipping container. So if you ever have to complain about not having enough space, go check out Ben's channel, because he works in a very tiny space and makes very good, efficient use of that space. But his problem in his shop, and he shoots these videos, there's no place to put a tripod because the tripod takes up a big footprint. So he made this little, articulating camera thing that he can hang up anywhere, and he goes how to make it either with a CNC or hand tools or whatever. He goes over everything. His videos are really well done. He's a very creative person, and I got to meet him last October and hang out with him. He's a good dude. You should be subscribed to his channel.
Right on. That is cool. I mean, he does a lot of things with recycled skateboards. And every time I see him or somebody else make these gigantic projects out of recycled skateboards, you see it and you're like, oh, wow, that looks like there's a guitar.
Right.
He has a guitar made. And you see all the stripes and a baseball bat and stuff. And you're like, wow, that looks really cool. And then when you actually watch him prepare the stock, the material to make these large things, I'm like, good grief. Like, there is no way I would have the patience to put in the amount of work just to get basic material to then make a project out of. It's crazy. There's a few people that do that type of work, and it blows my mind every time.
I think what I love about him is he has his thing. Like, he is the recycled skateboard guy. Like, he's in Los Angeles, so he can go around to all these skate shops and just collect all these things and then turn it into material. And that's his thing. I love people who have I love people who just have a thing, that a look or how they approach something. And that's just, it's super cool and creative.
Yeah, it is really cool. Right on. I'll go check him out. You guys got anything else before we wrap it up?
That's it. Thank you. Hope everybody is doing well.
Yes, I do. I do as well. Cool. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. Thank you. And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you, guys. Love you. I always have the tendency to want to hit the end button.
Don't.